Hey everyone, just a quick note before we get going here. This entire episode was recorded and produced the days just prior to the Monday morning announcement that Moderna's COVID vaccine mRNA-1273 is associated with 94.5% efficacy in preliminary data from the Phase 3 COVE trial. Obviously, there's going to be some Moderna discussion throughout this episode and how it pertains to the currently understood data from Pfizer. So just want to put that up front that obviously this wasn't something we had time to talk to our guest Dr. Schaffner with, but we'll have some more continued discussions about on ContagionLive.com throughout this week. So stay tuned for that and enjoy the episode. Thank you. I'm Kevin Kunzman, Managing Editor of Contagion. Welcome to the Vaccine Race Podcast. Let me start this episode by explaining the name of this podcast. Right now, phrases like Operation Warp Speed and herd immunity are being misinterpreted. Scientists joke to us their own loathe of the phrase warp speed and what it depicts the vaccine development progress to be. And other experts say the herd immunity argument has been misunderstood as a strategy for beating COVID-19 when it really should be a goal of outbreak management. Borderline semantics, but context is key when the stakes are this high. I'm not going to list all the elements of living in 2020 that contribute to us being a fast-reacting hyperbolic generation, but I will point out this pandemic has put a cinder block on our reactionary gas pedals. Half of us take everything we hear very literally, and the other half are the type to use terms like literally with reckless abandon. Add something that's been dictating every person's daily life for the last 8 months, and you're bound to see the lines like the ones that have been drawn. Here's something indisputable, though, and with no exaggeration. More than 1 million Americans tested positive for COVID-19 in the last week. Another 8,000 people died, and nearly 70,000 are hospitalized. Past trends show us the new case spike means that we can anticipate those numbers will get worse in the coming weeks. It's been 8 months since COVID-19 reached pandemic status, and the rate of new diagnoses and hospitalizations are reaching new highs now. And still, we argue and antagonize each other. We're still fixated on masking mandates. We're outwardly defying advisories on large gatherings. And when we see large gatherings happening, what do? We wish the people involved would get sick. Sometime early into this disaster, our country lost grip on the fact that we are not each other's enemies. The virus is the enemy, the lone enemy, and it's been winning so as long as we don't acknowledge that fact. There's nothing that we can do to end this pandemic that would be better carried out by just half of us. There's already too many faults in our country's systems that allow us to perfectly carry out a single plan that's tangible for all. But we need to find the right ideas from the right experts. We need to make concessions on our personal interests and make sure each other's needs are met. And then we need to work together even more. That brings me back to the name of this podcast. Vaccine Race is not meant to depict Pfizer, Moderna, and all these developers as stock cars ripping around turns toward a finish line. I know they're technically competitors, and even some of this data we're about to talk about carry an implication of one trying to beat another, but that's not our interest. That's not our coverage. Remember, COVID is the only enemy. We're losing, and again, experts are stressing we need more resources. The vaccine race is science against the pandemic. A win for science could be a win for all. So let's check in on how it's doing. Here are some updates from the Contagion COVID-19 Vaccine Tracker. 90%. Pfizer and BioNTech reported last week that their vaccine candidate, BNT162, will have supporting peer-reviewed data showing more than 90% efficacy in preventing COVID-19 infection in the coming weeks. The company's announcement added that no serious safety concerns were observed in its ongoing real-world 44,000-person Phase 3 trial right now. This first analysis will include data with 94 volunteers who have developed COVID-19, though it's currently not clear how many of the subpopulation were patients administered the vaccine or placebo. Pfizer intends to continue to assess the candidate overall protection from even more severe forms of the virus, as well as how it may benefit patients previously infected. The company now intends to request an EUA from the FDA later this month upon their finalized collection of mandated 2-month follow-up patient safety data. It anticipates that by the end of the year, they will have manufactured enough of the 2-dose vaccine to immunize 15 to 20 million people. Next, Moderna has stated preliminary data of its phase 3 trial for candidate mRNA-1273 is being prepared for submission to its monitoring board based on interim findings from at least 53 COVID-positive cases, a targeted trigger point for initial analyses of the mRNA platform vaccine. The phase 3 study was designed in collaboration with the FDA and NIH to evaluate Americans at the highest risk of severe COVID-19. It includes more than 7,000 Americans over the age of 65, as well as more than 5,000 Americans who are under the age of 65 with high-risk chronic diseases including diabetes, cardiometabolic disease, and severe obesity. Lastly, Brazil has suspended Sinovac's phase 3 trial for its COVID-19 vaccine due to the appearance of a serious adverse event. Citing privacy concerns, no further information about the serious adverse event was reported. However, the Chinese company said in a statement last week that they believed the adverse event was not related to the vaccine. The company had begun their phase 3 trial in Brazil back in July, and since that time they have had data updates and news on their vaccine, including in September when they reported positive data and showed an immune response in patients. Vaccine was well tolerated across low, medium, and high dosages, and there were no reports of serious adverse events at that time. So, as you've heard, we're weeks away from a possible FDA decision on the first coronavirus vaccine. What will follow that already weighty declaration is a series of unprecedented steps in manufacturing, storing, distributing, and monitoring said vaccine that will likely be followed with global scrutiny. No pressure, right? From a non-world implicating perspective, we're about to enter a fascinating stage of this process. So this week, to discuss everything from the impending Pfizer data to its potential provision monitoring, we called on a comprehensively qualified expert and a friendly source. Dr. William Schaffner, Professor of Preventive Medicine and Medicine at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, joins for today's interview. We hope you enjoy. So Dr. Schaffner, just to start off, I would love to actually read back a quote to you that we had from our conversation back in May, saying that we have to today in the 21st century have a product that's at least 80% effective when talking about a COVID-19 vaccine, and that we would even hope for more. Obviously, most arresting story right now in terms of the COVID vaccine development discussion has been Pfizer's new data from the beginning of this week showing 90% efficacy in preliminary data. Of course, this isn't peer reviewed. Of course, there's a whole process of interpreting safety data that we have to get to and we can talk about as well. But I just wanted to start off by asking you how you feel following your prediction back in May that we need something at least 80% and we're seeing preliminarily 90%.
Well, I have to tell you, very honestly, my initial reaction was, wow. I and many of my colleagues didn't think we would reach anything this effective. I was actually hoping for a vaccine that was at least 70% effective. If the more elaborate data reinforce this notion of 90% effectiveness, that's really quite stunning and very exciting. That said, let me add that we'll have to look at the data. How well does it work in older people, people with underlying illnesses and the like? And we all know that pregnant women were excluded, so that's a separate issue. And trials are now just beginning in children. So we don't have all the answers yet by any matter of means, but wow, light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, certainly. I think that was a lot of people's perception was, at least that this is the absolutely best possible good news of a first step. I think a lot of people are maybe misinterpreting it as the last step when we're really just getting this thing going now that we see that, right? So if we could talk a little bit about next steps, Dr. Schaffner, obviously Pfizer's alluding to sharing some data in the next few weeks. It sounds like the priority there is interpreting safety outcomes and, as you alluded to, the different patient populations. What else, you as an expert, what else are you looking for from it?
Well, the safety data are going to be very important. And pretty soon, Pfizer will submit an application to the Food and Drug Administration for an emergency use authorization. And then it will go to the external advisory group of the FDA. That will be a public meeting. A lot of us will attend it virtually to actually have a look at the data. And at the last meeting of this external advisory group, they were just, some of them, a little grumpy that we wouldn't have more safety data. this is a delicate circumstance. We would always like to have more safety data, but in the meantime, around 1,000 people a day are dying in the United States. So it's a balance of goods, right? But what we wouldn't want to do is start promoting a vaccine that fell on its face, that all of a sudden had a major safety issue, because that would muddy the water for all the subsequent vaccines. So we would like our next step to be as firm as this first step. We would like it to be a safe vaccine. And let me say right away, we're talking about serious adverse events. These vaccines, the first two vaccines that are going to be dealt with and released in all likelihood, these mRNA vaccines are quite reactogenic locally. And we just have to be prepared for that. We know about Shingrix, two doses, you can have sore arms and feel crummy for a day. These are Shingrix on steroids, I'm afraid. So we'll have to explain this to the recipients so they don't get grumpy and think something is seriously wrong if they have a sore arm for 2 or 3 days, or the next day have headache, or even a degree of fever and feel kind of punk. Some people have actually had to take a day off after they've received the vaccine. So we'll have to really explain that.
And others that may be very alarming to just a layman, being lightheadedness, as you said, you know, just a general fatigue, obviously sensations as if you are getting sick, is actually an indication of just the vaccine progressing through its work, right? So yeah, all that needs to be cleanly elaborated. And I'm glad you mentioned at the top, though, that obviously we're in a current state where the newest wave is actually the greatest and worst that we've seen thus far, in terms of total new cases, in terms of hospitalizations, and obviously daily deaths are increasing right now in late November. Dr. Schaffner, I was curious if, I mean, obviously the FDA has to hit, you know, its marks, and it's set a pretty strong precedent for what these vaccines need to clear before they reach the public. But in your opinion, and I guess in the experience of observing the FDA, could it be pressured right now by everything going on to assure that this vaccine is ready to go by the end of the year?
I think by the end of the year is a reasonable expectation. I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of the year or the very beginning of next year, we actually start vaccinating. And as you know, we'll have a priority list set up, who should be first, second, third, and fourth in line. And it is generally thought that first responders, healthcare workers who have direct care of COVID patients should be first. And I think we'll start vaccinating those people.
What size of the population does that look like? Do we have a tally of how many that would be?
Actually, we do, and I don't have that number. I don't want to give you a number off the top of my head. I'm sorry. But it's a fairly large number. One of the advantages of immunizing healthcare workers first has to do with safety surveillance, because there will be constant surveillance of safety once we start using this vaccine in large populations. And the CDC and the FDA have several mechanisms out there to evaluate safety. One of them is quite innovative. Namely, they're going to be using our smartphones, and the recipients of the vaccine will actually have to report in daily about what their symptoms are for a week, and then weekly thereafter for quite a considerable period of time. And so safety surveillance will be very tight. And if you don't report in, you'll be followed up. And that's very important in order to say, in the real world, as we start vaccinating hundreds of thousands of people, we continue to do careful safety assessment. Then when we start vaccinating the members of the more general public, we can provide even more reassurance about the safety of the vaccine.
Right. Right. Yeah. It sounds like obviously VAERS is ready to go with their plan of monitoring. And obviously FDA has a pretty storied history of, capable monitoring for vaccines that are made available, especially when it's for an unprecedented situation that stakes are heightened. And Dr. Schaffner, on the same note, another next step that we have that you alluded to before we got going here, something that might be riddled with some hurdles we need to clear is the actual distribution of the vaccine itself. And I know obviously storage is another concern, and then the process of actual administration. And I can't help but imagine from my perspective that's going to be a pretty messy scenario up front. Can you lay out what that's going to look like?
Yes, and it will be difficult because these mRNA vaccines are unstable. Mm-hmm. So they need a very rigorous cold chain. And the Pfizer vaccine, which is first in line here, mm-hmm. Actually has the most stringent demands. That mm-hmm. vaccine, during its shipping and handling, has to be kept at minus 70, 80 degrees centigrade. That's minus 94 Fahrenheit. That's cold. Mm-hmm. That's research deep freezer temperatures. And then after a vial is removed from that container, the contents have to be used very promptly. You can't put it in a refrigerator and use the rest of it the next day. So not only do we have to train people in how to handle the vaccine, we have to make sure that there are enough people ready to receive the vaccine once we start using it. Otherwise, we'll waste a lot of vaccine. We'll have to throw it out. So the logistical aspects are now being organized by our state health departments across the country. And obviously, with these kinds of constraints, this is not a vaccine that will be immediately available at your local pharmacy or the local doctor's office. You'll have to go to specific locations. And how to get the vaccine to rural areas, to nursing home workers, to people in small community hospitals, 30, 40 bed community hospitals. At least our state health department is thinking of a system of trucks that have that freezer capacity with a team doing a circuit ride, going around the hospitals and the nursing homes. Wow. And apropos of what I've just said, think about how complicated this gets. With all the local reactions, you probably don't want to vaccinate your whole staff on one day, because the next day, a percentage of them may be home in bed, not feeling terribly well or not caring to come into work because their arm hurts so much. So we're going to have to do this in stages. This is going to be logistically very challenging.
So we're talking about like doing laps past particular facilities.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. And yeah, as you alluded to, obviously Midwest is particularly burdened right now and having a difficult time managing the outbreak. And, they're constantly associated with our discussions around the need for telehealth, telemedicine measures and, just better resourcing miles and miles between the nearest healthcare facility for a lot of these patients that are also at severe risk of COVID infection. And it's a scary scenario. And when we look at the logistics of a vaccine, as you're pointing to, it's a little concerning. Do we have any concerns geographically, particularly geographically in the U.S. that we look at as, we need to get it under control here? Or is it really just going to be the prioritization of healthcare workers and then most at-risk populations nationwide?
I think it'll be more the latter. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the ACIP, has not made that final determination yet. But as a person who participates in those discussions, I have not heard geographic localization or anything like that. This will be distributed equitably across the states. As a matter of fact, the infection is increasing now literally in every state. So it's not as though some parts of the country are really spared from this illness. This virus is moving in a rather uncontrolled fashion. The whole country is a hotspot, in essence.
Yeah, well put. Thank you for that, Dr. Schaffner. And you mentioned too, in distribution, mRNA platform vaccines, very, very needy. But it also alludes to the other mRNA candidate that we have that we're waiting for now, Moderna. And I understand that just this week, they also announced that they hit their necessary COVID case total in their population. So sort of sounds like they're getting closer to, I guess, their own parade of preliminary non-peer-reviewed data, you know, highlight their big efficacy number, and then we'll be waiting for that. I was curious to know, Dr. Schaffner, what does that timeline look like, I guess, between, you know, hitting the benchmark for preliminary data and when that kind of announcement would come?
Well, again, I think it might come sometime later this month or in December. Mm-hmm. And the spring of the year, I think we'll have availability with any kind of good luck, at least two vaccines, which will introduce yet another wrinkle. Because you can't start with one and finish with the other. You can't mix and match, as they say. You have to have coherence. You have to keep up with the same vaccine. And that means our statewide immunization registries, the immunization information systems, really are going to play a very critical role so that we can be very precise about who's gotten which vaccine.
Right. Wow. And I mean, is there any precedent? I mean, none of this has precedent, but is there any reason to expect, you know, say Moderna came out and had 95% efficacy and the safety data is mind-blowing and suddenly we realize this is the one we should be leading with. There's no way we could possibly, obviously distribution deals are done and set in ink. There's no way we could reprioritize our strategy for greater vaccination, right? This is something that's going to be a real, a mix of different candidates, as you're talking about, to different people.
Well, it's going to get even more complicated as yet more vaccines come to the point of emergency use authorization, because we anticipate during 2021 there'll be yet other vaccines. Yeah. And some vaccines may work better in some subpopulations than others. We'll have to see that. Right. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices anticipates looking at each vaccine and making a separate recommendation for each one.
Wow. So, I mean, you know, that also feeds into a question I would have regarding 2021, something that we talked about back in May and is still obviously an open-ended question, I think, when we're discussing these is obviously so many of these candidates are going to require a booster dose and have been assessed as such, but we don't particularly understand long-term efficacy. We don't really understand long-term immunity in general for COVID-19 right now, even in infected patients who have recovered. Dr. Schaffner, I guess, what are going to be our benchmarks beyond, obviously, patient self-monitoring for you know, outcomes of safety? How are we going to monitor efficacy once these are real world?
Well, Kevin, you're right on. That's obviously something we don't know, whether for the natural infection and certainly not for the vaccine. And so in addition to continuous safety monitoring, the CDC is going to continuously monitor for effectiveness in the real world. And we're going to try to do this vaccine specific. So these are enormous challenges going ahead, but the CDC has got plans for that. And as long as it continues to be well supported, and we all have our fingers crossed, we ought to be able to generate those data as time evolves. And as I've told all my friends who ask how long will the protection from the vaccine last, we'll all have to stay tuned. Obviously, we don't know that at the beginning of this process.
Wow. Okay. Okay. So looking at all this and going ahead, you know, it sounds like conversations that we've had with people near to the Pfizer data and everything anticipates that the discussion is eventually going to turn to the logistics of everything else. And obviously, we've touched on now distribution and management, everything like that, how we're going to get these out. I wasn't sure, Dr. Schaffner, if even past the phase, I guess, of where we're at with these mRNA vaccines, looking back towards some of these phase two or three candidates that we're still getting down the pipeline, is there any that you have had growing or more particular interest in that we could look at now as getting to that process?
Well, we're interested in them all, but there are a couple. Yeah. There's one vaccine that's only a single dose vaccine. Well, that's very attractive. There's another one that's using an adjuvant, which the early data would indicate that you get really high antibody levels from. But that's very early. It's just starting its phase three large clinical efficacy trials. So that's another one that we have clearly an eye on. But you know, there are vaccines that are being developed around the world. In the news recently, the Russians are vaccinating. They're starting to vaccinate select populations even before their phase three trials are completed. Yeah. The Chinese are doing the same thing, and they have more than one vaccine candidate mm-hmm. currently under study. And so this is a turbulent field. It's science rich. The 21st century science enables scientific groups now all over the world to work on trying to provide vaccines. And we need that. We're trying to vaccinate not just our population, we're trying to immunize the global population against this disease. So we need as much help as we can get.
Right. Right. And I was actually going to ask you too, how do we feel about the Russian, the Russian vaccine data came out, I think 92%. I read a column the other day. I couldn't help but laugh. Someone commenting that, you know, I hope they didn't just add a two to the 90% reported by Pfizer and put it out there. You know, there's obviously a lot of discussion around the transparency behind that and the supposed one-upsmanship that kind of goes along with the timing of their data releases and announcements. I mean, is there any reason that we should feel assured in a way that Russia is, you know, reporting good news, or at least is, you know, leading us to believe that they're having success with their vaccine?
Assured? No. Skeptical? Yes. I'm reminded of what I was taught as a fellow, in God we trust, all others must provide data. And so we would like to see the data from the Russian trials, right? So let's hold our horses and just take this one step at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. Enough of the big numbers. I think we need to see some actual meatier data, as you're alluding to. So that's great to hear. Thanks, Doc. And, another point that I think is pretty interesting, and I want to run it by you before we get off here, is, when we're talking about the strategy to achieve, and I'm going to use the term in the meaning of it being a goal and not a strategy of herd immunity, in terms of assuring that the population has majority immunity against SARS-CoV-2 infection, and thus we can resume some more normalized parts of our society, societal structure. Sure. The strategy behind that someone suggested to me, that as we get these vaccines would be more ideal, is obviously to immunize the most at-risk populations versus the strategy of the herd immunity group, who has come out and essentially suggested an infection of younger at lesser risk people could develop immunity and eventually protect the at-risk population. He suggested it should be the other way around. We vaccinate the most at-risk populations and they in fact keep the younger, lesser risk populations safe. Is that what we see eventually being our end game? Is that the goal?
Well, actually, these issues have been debated extensively within the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and there have been all kinds of models that have been given to us. And actually, they all look as though if you go first and give it to the highest risk people, you actually prevent the most deaths. But the differences are very small, interestingly enough, and curiously. I've always been a little skeptical of models. They're interesting, but not compelling. They're kind of like war plans, right? They're a little bit divorced from reality, but nonetheless, they are instructive. I think, remember, we'll have the least information, no information really about children. We will have information about people 18 through older age. And I think either essential workers or people at highest risk will be second in line. The committee hasn't quite decided which is which. It's about 6-1 half a dozen to the other. Right. Most other external groups have put an emphasis on vaccinating those at greatest risk next.
Right. And looking at that population too, obviously the greater discussion being, how do we reach these populations that are victims of healthcare disparity, who have kind of come to distrust the medical process to some extent and are averse to vaccination in general, and you know, how exactly, you know, as they're so greatly burdened by COVID, they're still not at a greater susceptibility to trust someone with a needle, right? So how do we reach them?
That is a very serious issue, because survey after survey and anecdotes, testimonials from minority physicians who work with minority populations tell us that the skepticism is really very extensive and pretty baked in minority populations, particularly African Americans. And of course, they're disproportionately affected by COVID. We're going to have to make real efforts to reassure and provide information to that population so that they can make a positive decision regarding vaccine. That will take a lot of cooperative work.
Right. Thanks for that, Dr. Schaffner. And on the last note, obviously something, a bigger benchmark, I guess, in American news in the last couple of weeks, obviously, has been the election of a new president-elect. And with that came a pretty quick and sweeping wave of news, I guess, in terms of federal stance changing and strategies changing in our response to COVID-19. Obviously, Operation Warp Speed has benefited the development and progression of a lot of our candidates, and we're now in a position now where we can start considering those, of course. But new regimen leads to ask questions of, do we imagine strategies changing at all, especially at a point when we are talking about actual distribution and actual vaccination? I mean, there's been a lot of discussion, I think, recently about a potential lockdown or something alluding to a lockdown to at least mitigate the spread before we start vaccinating. Do you foresee that at all? Or?
Well, my ear to the ground tells me that plans for vaccine distribution are going to go on as currently planned. They look very, very solid. As to other aspects of COVID control, I think we will see a much more national perspective. As to your specific question regarding a lockdown, I think a complete lockdown is unlikely. I think that would go down very thin. Partial lockdowns might be important. Let me put it this way. A lot of us think that we've put the cart of opening up the economy before the horse of COVID control. As we now put the horse back in front of the cart, trying to control the virus so that opening the economy can be more brisk and safe, My friends in public health have to remember that the horse and the cart are linked. We're going to have to do them both. They're hitched together. So as we work on controlling COVID, we also have to work on the economy. And from a very personal point of view, I think we need to pay more attention to all of those people who have been disemployed and really hurt economically, socially, and culturally by COVID. We haven't paid enough attention to them. The virus control and control of what's happening in our society socioeconomically are hitched together. We need to give attention to both.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. There's room for growth in both responses. And, you know, both are pretty, as you're pointing out here, they're both pretty controlling and, you know, harmful to the scenario we find ourselves in. And they are absolutely linked in that way. So thanks for that, Dr. Schaffner. And I wasn't sure if there's anything else you'd want to add relative to what we've discussed.
Just a point that's not quite minor, I would say. These trials of the vaccine will not tell us whether the vaccine prevents infection. They will tell us whether it prevents illness. And so the notion that once vaccinated, we can throw our mask in the trash is incorrect. And I think the average person will be very surprised to hear the notion, you've gotten the vaccine, put back on your mask and keep it on for a while until we can determine whether these vaccines actually prevent the transmission of infection. So those are two issues. We'd surely like to prevent disease, particularly severe disease, but we also need to focus on interrupting the transmission of this virus. And we don't know that these vaccines will do that. That assessment is not part of the trials. We'll have to keep studying that.
Right. Wow. Wow. So almost like phase four.
Like that.
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, Dr. Schaffner, thank you so much for your time and insight on this. Really appreciate it as always. And hopefully next time we talk, it's even better news to discuss. It seems like it gets, at least in terms of vaccine development, the discussion is better and better news. And hopefully we get everything under control. So it's all good news.
Progress, slow but sure. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Doc.
Thanks again to Dr. Schaffner for his perspective on everything COVID-19 vaccines as we begin to take the next steps of this fast-moving yet long-time-coming process. And for more COVID-19 vaccine news and insights, be sure to visit us at contagionlive.com. Until next time, I'm Kevin Kunzman. Thanks for following the race.